you can host the best backyard barbecue. When you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
The Incomparable, number 600, February 2022.
Welcome back, everybody, to The Incomparable. I am your host, Jason Snell, and in this episode, we're going to break out the old book club. That's right. We're going to read books that might get nominated for awards later. We don't know. But we're reading them anyway, which I know is weird, because so many of our book club episodes these days are things that are on shortlists for awards and things. But we thought maybe it would be nice to just talk about some books that we read and I think liked. So we are going to talk about two books. We're going to talk about The Witness for the Dead by Catherine Addison. It is in the same universe as The Goblin Emperor, which we also loved many years ago, but is not a sequel quite. You could read it without having read that one. And we're also going to talk about A Desolation Called Peace, which is a sequel to a book you really should have read, or it will make no sense. So, but to one of my favorite books of the last few years. So, A Memory Called Empire. Anyway, joining me on the book club tonight are the following wonderful people. And Glenn Fleischman. Glenn Fleischman is here. Hello.
Wow. Just starting out hot. Starting out hot. Hello, Jason.
Starting out, you were in episode one. So I think that the foundation has been laid. And you're still, you're still here. I mean, that nothing has worked yet. So welcome.
Keep trying.
Scott McNulty.
Happy to be here.
Scott McNulty is also here, also from episode one.
That's right. Unassigned reading is exciting. So I didn't have to read these books, but I did.
But you did.
And now I'm going to talk about
them. I appreciate that.
I don't remember them, but I'll pretend.
One of my goals. Yeah, it goes without saying that you don't remember what happened in them. But we'll see if we can jog your memory or create a facsimile of you remembering.
Ooh.
Also from episode one, it's Dan Morin.
Oh, from episode one. Jason, you want to feel old? All these people are on episode one. And it was a really long time ago.
It's true. It was very long ago now. Erica Ensign was not on episode one. We found her much later on, but it feels like she's been here forever. Hi.
Hi. It does feel like I've been here for a very long time, but not that long. No. So I'm less old. That's how that works.
Wow.
It's just math.
Cool.
That's right. That's right.
As old as you geezers.
By the time you joined, Glenn had created like five more ways to make weird noises on his podcast track.
Exactly.
So
that's true.
That you missed out on the original.
It's an evolving art form.
Unfiltered Glenn, believe it or not.
Even 20 coming up.
We process Glenn's audio a lot is what I'm saying. So, you know.
Jason, I like the way that you described these books in terms of being a sequel of a thing that you should have read in a book that came after something you didn't need to read. And I did it backwards. Sort of.
Whoa.
I did. Yeah. I dove into A Desolation Called Peace, not having reread
A Memory Called Empire
in a long time. Like, I had just read it the one time. And it was a little rough sledding for a while, but I just kept going. And then, and finished it, and loved it. Thus, I'm here. And then I started The Witness for the Dead, which you really don't need to have even read The Goblin Empire for. And yet, about three pages in, I was like, boy, I just don't remember how this world works. I need to go back. So I reread The Goblin Emperor before I read The Witness for the Dead. So I have done it backwards, and I admit it.
The Goblin Emperor was a lot longer ago, though, right?
So it was. That's true. And it, I feel like it's a faster read in terms of being able to zip through it.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's right, too. Mm-hmm. Let's start with The Witness for the Dead, because, again, it's a book that you don't have to have done the reading before you might want to, but you wouldn't have to do the pre-reading of The Goblin Emperor. I remember when The Goblin Emperor came out that Catherine Addison, who is actually Sarah Monette, right, mm-hmm. Erica?
But this yes, is her, that's correct.
This is her, this is a pen name, that she said The Goblin Emperor was a standalone novel, and that at some point she made a declaration that she was not planning any sequels to The Goblin Emperor. Mm-hmm. But a funny thing happened, which is, and that book came out in 2014, got nominated for a lot of awards. I loved it. It was great. Mm-hmm. In 2021, Witness for the Dead comes out, and it is about a character who appears in Goblin Emperor and set in parts of the kind of far off parts of the world of the Goblin Emperor, which is this, we should say, for people who haven't read the Goblin Emperor, it's a fantasy world, but it's kind of, I mean, Erica, should I call it steampunky?
Oh, I knew you were going to go there.
There's steam.
Yeah, I don't think
there are any punks. Are there punks? There are no punks.
It's not steampunky because it's realistic technology.
Are there zeppelins? Yes, there are zeppelins.
They have technology that makes sense. It's actual practical technology. It's not fetish technology. So
you know what?
Steampunk.
I will cop right off the bat to not really loving this book as much as I wanted to, and it actually has a lot more steampunky elements than The Goblin Emperor did.
Yeah,
it does. So I feel like maybe that's part of why.
There's a whole like steam factory where they're working on
like trains and
steam things. Yeah, mm-hmm. It's
I
true.
Like trains.
It's true. So it's a fantasy world. My point is, it's a fantasy world, but. You know, it is more steampunky than it is high fantasy, I think would be fair to say. And there is, you know, the Goblin Emperor, the idea here is this is a world with elves and goblins and there's magic, but it's magic of a different kind of sort, I guess. And it's got urban areas, and I don't know, it doesn't feel like another riff on Tolkien. It's different. And that's the thing I liked about The Goblin Emperor. And it continues here in Witness for the Dead, where it's set in that world. But one of the things that I found delightful in Witness for the Dead is that it's kind of a detective novel.
It's definitely a detective novel.
And I was going to call it a mystery, but it's not quite that because what happens is there is a core mystery, but at various points, the main character is told, you must leave town to conduct an investigation of a different mystery.
Yes,
and they're like, oh, yes. Okay, fine. And they go and do that. And so I think that's really, I like the mixing of genres. And our main character is the Witness for the Dead. Their power is to be able to get a read on a dead body, essentially, and know something about their thoughts or memories or other things from the impressions of them after they have died. And therefore, it's kind of a calling. And whenever somebody dies, they really do need to be of service. And it ends up being that they become kind of like a detective, but it's from a different angle. It's almost, it is essentially like a religious calling to be the witness for the dead. Dan, you said definitely a mystery novel. So
yeah, it is definitely a mystery novel. Like you said, it doesn't quite have the trapping. Like it has the trappings, but not quite the substance of your traditional mystery novel. I was just talking to my wife about this because she read it quite recently, and she said it's kind of like fantasy noir. And I was like, yeah, it definitely has that that aspect
yep.
to it a little bit of like, you know, the detective who keeps kind of getting in a little bit over their head. And like having to sort of solve all these things. And sometimes there are like intertwinings between some of what's going on or larger implications in terms of what's going on. And they're not exactly, I mean, the protagonist isn't exactly like a reluctant detective, but there is an element mm-hmm. of reluctance about him. So well,
it's, yeah. he's kind of been exiled. And
right.
and there's because of awkward things that happen that are in the Goblin Emperor, actually. And so they are, yeah, not really kind of in a great happy place. And I think that gives the main character kind of a noirish detective feel.
He's not reluctant to do his job. He's totally fine with his calling at this point. He's reluctant to interact with people, is the way that works.
It's, yeah, there's kind of this interesting split. It's actually a little, remind me a little of the Simenon mysteries because of the French police system. So there's like this police judiciaire sort of thing. So he's kind of like an investigator, like an inspector, little Columbo-like, sort of rumbles around, mm-hmm. looks at things, but he's not out there like on a beat. You know, the Vigilant Brotherhood are the cops, right? They're like out on the beat, kind of, oh, well, when you need us, call us in and then we'll arrest the guy kind of thing. And he's not really a judge, right? There's a whole judicial system that's described. So he has this unique, we kind of like, I mean, we collectively as American Canadian society, maybe we kind of like a detective who is distant from the helpfulness mechanisms of the legal system or the police legal system, so that they go off on their own. They have hunches. They're following these improbable paths, and they come to a truth that can't be accomplished by sort of really rigid, straight walking research, right? He has to go down all these blind alleys, and he's taken off because of political considerations. You're off the case, MacGyver, you know, it's like, right, you're off the case. We're going to send you to this dangerous place that you have to survive an ordeal because you're telling the truth. You know, he's a truth teller, and he's incapable of not telling the truth. And I think that fits that detective, the lone detective model we like.
The brutal
too.
Honesty, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we'd rather be talking, I think the line is that we'd rather be talking to the dead people than to the live people.
Yeah.
And there's a truth in that. The wandering aspect of it, I really love that. I like, it's like, to come back to, like, I think you're right, Glenn, about, you know, not a cop quite and not a judge, but kind of in the middle. Also, there's this idea that is like somebody who's juggling a bunch of assignments that I think is so novel and I thought fun, where sometimes they're, he set off to go stay the night in the old graveyard, and if you survive, we'll know that you're okay. And of course, because it's a witness for the dead, you know, he sees like ghosts and stuff, but manages to survive that. But also the thing of like, oh yeah, there's some like attacks out in the countryside, and it might be a supernatural monster, so we're gonna send you out in the countryside. And he's like, right, but I'm right. Solving a crime. And they're like, go get out, you got to get out of town, there's politics going on, get out. Yeah. He's like, all right, I guess. And then, and it, rather than it just being a plot point of like, you've ruffled feathers in town, they're very rich people who are very upset that you're nosing into their business, but all we really do is send him off for a minute. It's like, no, the stuff out in the countryside is really interesting, where there's like, I forget what the monsters are, but they're basically
ghouls.
They're ghouls, right? So it's like, mm-hmm. they can create more undead if they aren't stopped. They're very dangerous, and if they get in a graveyard, like, they can turn more undead. So it's actually a very serious thing out there, but it's also just a huge shifting of gears in the story. And I can see that some people will be like, come on, get back to the main story, but I just kind of love that the book just takes a left turn and just goes, nope, we're doing this for a while now. I loved it.
Jason, you might remember back when I read this book, I put a query out into a Slack group and said, I don't quite get this book. It came out months ago. I was like, I feel like I'm missing something. I really do love Catherine/Sarah's writing. I think it just fills me with this sort of place sense, and everything's very inhabited, and I just love reading it. So it doesn't have to go anywhere for me to enjoy it, but I felt like I'm missing something. It felt very picaresque. Like, this thing happens to Kelahar, and then he goes here and here, and then he goes to the haunted war mountain and so forth, the ghouls. And you're like, this is kind of feels like a set of, is there like a giant, you know, big boss battle coming? And then the thing kind of ended, and I was like, what just happened? But, you know, you said, no, I thought it's pretty good. And a couple of people, no, this is really good. So I reread it for the podcast, and I'm glad I did, because I was not in the right mode when I read it last. Or maybe I'll bring this up early. The long names get to me sometimes. I realized reading this and also the Arcady Martine books, the Desolation Called Peace and
Memory Called Empire,
that I sub-vocalize in a very interesting way, which I didn't know. I read quite rapidly, but when I hit words that are 23 letters or longer, I have stuff to close. Anyway, but when I reread it, I felt the picaresque part went away, and I picked up the whole thread of the novel. I also think I read a preview chapter that Amazon had released of The Witness for the Dead. Then I read the novel, you know, some weeks later. I may either have missed some, or maybe there was something missing from the preview chapter, because when I reread it, I'm like, I don't remember these facts at all. This totally changes my understanding of the rest of the book.
So. All right.
I wonder if I ran into some of the same issues with that, because I mean, part of the reason that I stopped so swiftly and went back and reread The Goblin Emperor is because I was having trouble with with the, not just long words, but just the language and, you know, the way, you know, they have different, it's not Mr. and Mrs. and Ms. There are all kinds of different titles for people depending on whether they are, you know, male or female or not, or married or
dukes,
like all kinds of
dukes,
stuff.
Barons.
Yeah, yeah. And I had, I was kind of struggling with that. And unfortunately, rereading The Goblin Empire, Emperor didn't help all that much because I felt like there was a lot more of it in this book. And I appreciated the attention to detail and the world building and, you know, the fact that, you know, he goes off into the country and you learn a whole bunch about how the reason that it's so important in this world to have really thick slabs of stone over people's graves is because if you don't, their bodies can rise up and become ghouls. Yeah. And that's a bad thing, and you have to make sure that the cemeteries are all tended very well, and like, you know, all that kind of stuff was interesting, but I maybe I wasn't in the right reading mode, and maybe I was just off put just enough by trying to follow the language and the politics that it didn't grip me. But I also am the kind of person who much prefers a point A to point B to point C type novel as opposed to something that's a little bit more, you know, anthologized within one story.
It makes me think in the way we're talking about it now and all the sort of disparate things that happen in this book, I, you know, sort of draw a line between this and some of Becky Chambers' work with her.
Mm-hmm. You know, same thought.
And I mean, it's a different story. This hangs, I think, a little bit more together. I actually think there is more of a through line plot in this than in some of those books.
This is more like a modern prestige drama where there's a very strong story arc, but still some episodic stuff. Whereas some of Becky Chambers' books are like a season of Star Trek: The Next Generation or something, where they're like
here's another story.
Yeah, this is like there's the main plot, like carries through to the end. And everything's connected, but yeah, it still is comfortable enough to go away for an episode into the countryside.
Which is fascinating, too, in a book that is this short. It's not a long book, right? Like, it's only a couple hundred pages, and that is, you know, it feels like in some ways maybe it's a blown-up novella in some ways with, like, a bunch of little short stories put in it, which is a fascinating structure, and I didn't dislike it for being that. I thought it was interesting, and I liked that aspect of it that you're describing with the sort of like, let's investigate different parts of this world. Let's do these cases. They may or may not have any bearing on one another, but they're all sort of related through this central protagonist. And we just get to see all the different aspects of his job.
It's rare to read. No, I shouldn't say that. I was going to say it's rare to read something that's this meditative with but that's not right. I mean, there's a lot of detective novels that are quite meditative, but there's usually a lot of action, right? People are being shot, people being thrown out of doors, and then somebody meditates on life and death. And, you know, there's kind of this mix in the ones that are most contemplative that there's a lot going on and there are strings being pulled. And in this, there's a lot less going on. I mean, you know, not, this is not spoilery yet, but like there's explosions and attempted killings and all kinds of stuff happen, you know, and poisonings, all kinds of stuff going on, but it's almost offstage-ish from our main character. Yeah. He's so insulated from it. And I mean, I guess that's the point too, is that he comes in
when the bodies are already dead.
Yeah. But the other thing is, this is true, I think, of the Martine novel as well, is this book, when I'm reading it the second time, so I went back and read Goblin Empire after reading Witness for the Dead the second time. This is how committed I am. And really enjoyed Goblin Empire. I'd forgotten a chunk of plot points. I remembered the main point, and I didn't remember Thar Kelahar, the witness, so much in it, his role. But this feels a little bit like half of a, I mean, there's another part coming, right? She's already announced a sequel to Witness for the Dead. Yeah. That's going to be an actual sequel. So the same thing with, we'll talk about the other book, but it feels a little bit like, it's, we're not in the middle of the story, but a big arc was completed. But I felt like, I mean, I think Dan's right. It's not really a novella, but it's kind of like a bigger thing is about to happen, and we're not really in the middle. She didn't cut it in half, but there's something a little missing, even though, again, I enjoyed it reading it a second time. I enjoyed it more, and, you know, I will read anything she writes because she's a wonderful writer, so hard to argue with that.
Maybe I do need to read it again. Actually, I had a rather interesting experience in that I think I finished this 2 or 3 weeks ago, and 2 days ago, when I was thinking about doing this podcast, I had like picked up my Kobo, and I think it said like 67% read or something. Sometimes I jump around after I have finished the book, or there's some text afterwards, so it shows that it's not done. And I was like, oh crap, did I not finish this book? And I literally sat there for a good 3 minutes straight thinking, what happened at the end of this book? Did I finish it? Did I actually finish it? And I had gotten it from the library, so I couldn't just flip to the end and check it. And I genuinely completely forgot what happened at the end of the book. I eventually realized, okay, yes, I remember finishing the book, and I remember thinking, oh, that's it. So I remember that reaction, but I could not tell you what actually happens at the very end of the book, because I just remember my feeling of being like, oh. So I, you know, maybe when there's more after this, I will be more inclined to try it again.
That's just how I felt after reading it the first time. I felt like I missed something because the book just ended. The second time I was like, I don't know. I think I read it really fast. The second time I read it in kind of a flurry. And then it hit me a lot stronger. I don't know if it's a recommendation for a book that says, well, you should really read it two or three times. But
well, it's only 240 pages.
I read it on a beach in Hawaii and I loved it. And I just ripped right through it because I was having a great time. And it was, yeah, it was good. And also, it just hit the spot, like it, as a fun mystery, fantasy mystery detective story. And also, I think there's something about, I think we all like it to all like to think that when we watch a TV show about cops or detectives or whatever, I think there's something about wanting to think that there's a force out there that is committed to be the witness for the dead, to make sure that justice is done and that the truth comes out. And I think that this book taps into that in an interesting way, in making our main character have essentially a religious devotion to it, that this is a task that cannot be refused. It must be completed. And that's the kind of detective you really want, right? The one who, in addition to the magical powers that can speak for the dead, also it's basically, this is not just their job, but essentially their life's calling is to make sure that the truth comes out about all of these things, no matter what happens in terms of wealthy, powerful people being upset by it.
Name of the Rose, sort of. I mean, not really, but yeah, you know, same thing, maybe.
That's in the ballpark, yeah.
And the witness for the dead is not the only kind of, like, there's a specific type of witness. So there's, mm-hmm, like, he's one that's a witness for the dead, but they also have somebody who's like, you know, an airship explodes, and there's a witness for the airship itself. So it's, I really like that touch of this society, that they actually have somebody speaking for, you know, different things that have no voices, mm-hmm, which is basically the whole idea, mm-hmm, behind that. And I really found that fascinating.
Not forget the witness for the prosecution.
I could never.
There's that moment, because again, it's a magical thing to be able to see what happened to somebody when they died, and he gets called to the wealthy family. And the patriarch has died, and there's a contested will of like which son is going to be the one who inherits everything, and there's like a fake will, or they insist it's a real will and all of that, and they're like, we're going to talk to the witness for the dead and find out, and they're like, we want you to read him and very specifically tell us who he wanted his fortune to go to, and our main character tells the truth, finds out the answer, and tells the truth. And it is a world of trouble, right? It is very much like a detective learning something that is a dangerous piece of information. And because you have to take the witness for the dead on faith, essentially, that they're telling the truth. And so people don't. They just don't. They're like, no, you're lying. You're obviously a liar. And it causes a lot of trouble for this character. But I kind of love the idea that it doesn't really matter. The character is going to do what he's going to do. And that this is the truth of what that person was thinking when they were dying about who they were going to give their fortune to.
Oh, yeah. And some people in his order, or sort of related to his order, don't even believe that witnesses for the dead can.
Oh, yeah. He's on the outs. That's the other thing, is he is an outsider. Yeah. Like the management and like hate him.
He keeps showing up. How many scenes are there in the book? This is not a spoiler also. How many scenes are in the book where he's covered in mud or something terrible has happened to him and he's called in front of the prince or the, you know, the not the arch prelate, but whoever the top religious authority is.
Very
like constantly being hauled in front of people. He's like, I am dressed inappropriately. I'm covered in moss and dirt.
Yep. Yeah, it's kind of charming.
I know I sound very down on this book, and I didn't dislike it. I think it's definitely worth reading, you know, especially if you enjoyed the Goblin Emperor. But don't go in expecting something that's super similar. Actually, one big difference: I had remembered the Goblin Emperor. I had remembered it as being told in first person, and it's not.
Yeah,
it's just third person from the perspective of Maya, the character in that book. This book is actually first person, and I think that was one of the things that didn't work for me quite so well, simply because this is a character who, as we've talked about, like, would sort of rather be communing with the dead than talking with actually people. And it's very just sort of uncomfortable with himself and his own personal history. And he's got a lot of issues and trauma and stuff that he's dealing with. And I feel like, you know, a first person that's told well, and this is told well, really kind of puts you in the head of that character. And this was not a head that I wanted to be in at this point in my life. So...
Scott, yeah. You read a lot of science fiction and fantasy, but also a lot of other things, including, I think, mysteries. What did you think of this one?
Well, it was enjoyable to listen to you talk about it, because I vaguely remember the things that happened in this book, which is why I've been quiet, because I don't really remember much of anything. I have no idea what happens at the end of this book. I have read it. I promise you, I have read it.
There's a showdown at the Zeppelin factory, and... Yeah.
Are you only assigning us books that have
goggles on?
Yes. That's been my secret for 600 plus episodes.
I missed this.
But when I was rereading the Wikipedia entry, because I don't reread books, I was surprised, and people have already said this, but just how much stuff is stuffed in this 240-page book. It's just, there's a lot going on, and it doesn't feel like there's a lot going on, which is kind of a weird... juxtaposition, right? It feels so many detective stories or mysteries, there's a central mystery that the character is propelled through the plot to solve, right? They're very plot driven, with kind of strong characters. So you identify with the main character, the Columbo, whoever, and there's a plot, there's a bad person that needs to be punished, or, you know, the detective is a complicated person and maybe they're complicit or something like that. And this book, I feel like it's more of a meditation on the character themselves than what they're doing. Mm. And so, like Glenn said, most of the exciting things feel like they happen off stage, and we are seeing it through, you know, he shows up when everyone has been killed and he's like, okay, I'll talk to their corpses and see what I can find out. And then moves on and then goes, you know, to a hill and talks to ghosts and kills some undead people. And then, you know, a Zeppelin blows up maybe.
Yep.
And he solves three mysteries and
that's it.
He feeds a cat.
I will say that the part that I liked the best was the part that I found the most vibrant. I think Scott, like saying that it is a meditation is like that, I think, describes the book overall very well. And the bits that I liked the best were the least meditative. And that's so there's a character that he meets in the course of he's investigating the murder of a woman who turns out to have been an opera singer. And when he goes to the opera house, the guy who is sort of like the director and a composer who's in charge is this just very colorful, big personality. And I just love that character. And like, there's a bit of a flirt happening, and I'm just shipping these two characters as hard as I possibly can. And the book just is still intent on being a slow meditative thing, and he has to go take a trip, and I think I was maybe a little bit frustrated by that, because like, I just wanted those two crazy kids to get together. So I will definitely be reading the next book to see.
I love that the murder victim has been stealing dresses,
many.
That's right.
Yeah. From the and has a, like an extra large closet full of the stolen dresses, and that our main character basically tells the person who runs the opera, like, yeah, you should send a person over there because
with a cart.
She's got all the dresses. So
everybody hated her. So that, you know, that's an interesting bit of
the mystery thing,
is that, you know, you don't know who the murderer is, and it could even be this. A wonderfully adorable character that I'm shipping our detective with, because he also hated her and is not, you know, he makes no bones about it. So
right, but it doesn't matter even if she's awful, because that's the job of our character, is to be her witness. Mm-hmm. And once he finds out that she's murdered, like, he's on the case, he's on the job, he can't not do it. I love that. Again, it just It has those things like people who listen to this podcast, and I think they get, we got feedback from our episode where we did the 2010s book draft, where people said one of our skills as a podcast collectively is saying enough about a book that people know whether they want to read it or not, or know whether they'll like it or not. And I feel like we've done a pretty good job of that with this book. Yeah.
Instantly, I'm so glad to know we have skills.
Yeah, well, I mean, finally, after 10 years, we figured it out. So I love this book because I thought the mysteries, it's not quite cozy, but it was like kind of like that. It was like a fun series of mysteries. And also because I love the protagonist because they're an outsider, but they have a calling and they have to do this thing. Like, I really love detectives who are broken people who are compelled to solve the mystery, even if it affects them badly, right? Like, I love that. That's such a great kind of a story to tell, and this is what that story is. So I liked it a lot. And
should I point out, for people like tea, there's a lot of tea in this book.
Oh, there's so much tea.
So much tea. So many.
Making me thirsty just thinking
so
about it.
So much. They're going to places and having different kinds of tea, and there's details of what all the different made-up fantasy teas are and stuff, which is...
Yeah.
Yeah, she had a lot of fun with that.
Can I read one sentence from the book, because I think it might show something about the names.
How long is the sentence?
It's going to take. It's got a lot of names in it. The other is it's half the book, Dan. This is the other is I just wanted to look up. It's Pen Thenior is the which is a great or Pel Thenior. Sorry, is the is the theatrical the opera director who it is funny. He threatens to keep taking over the book. Erica is what I'd suggest. He shows up, everything livens up, and he's like, "Well, maybe I am the murderer. Oh, do you suspect me? Well, let us go flirt here, meet my mother." And you're like, "Wait a minute, hold on." And then he disappears for a while. But so here's the sentences. See if I can get this right. It's Pel Thenior and Min Vadresharad came down from the catwalk stage piece, and Merolora and Min Vakresharad walked through the movements of the overseer, stalking Chelshu across the stage and up the stairs that would put Min Vakresharad in the right place to jump at the right time. I had problems with sentences like that.
Yeah.
So that just to give people
it's tough is to do pronouns too.
It is the hardest thing about both of these books is that the proper names are complicated. It actually goes with the other book we're talking about, where one of the issues is you have to process interesting, not commonly seen in English literature names and titles, and you got to internalize it, or you will not know who anyone is. Like, because you'll be like, which one is this? Who is this now? And it's an interesting choice that adds a lot of flavor, but at the cost of understanding sometimes.
It's a great challenge, but I don't know. It's hard to overcome. I cite Anathem, where I felt like Neal Stephenson's book, where I felt like the first time I read it, I sort of got it and kind of liked it. And the second time I was like, oh, he's rewired my brain.
Yeah.
And now I can read this book because I know all the words he made up.
Right. Yeah, it's a little like that.
Did this book have a glossary? I don't remember, because I know the other one did.
This does not.
And by the other one, I mean a Desolation Cult.
I think the Goblin Emperor might have a very elaborate... The Goblin Emperor, I think, has an incredibly lengthy description. In fact, when I was rereading it, I was like, wait a minute, is the whole book this opening part? I'm trying to remember. Anyway, Witness for the Dead did not have... that, right? It did not have
I didn't think it did, but
oh yeah, here we go. Yeah, if Goblin Emperor has like I'm looking at like it seems like 36 pages that are about pronunciation. There are no silent letters in Ethruphoras and so forth. So if you read that book, you can understand how to say all the names in The Witness for the Dead. I don't mean to be negative either. It's like I think it's great for authors to make choices like this where they're not trying to make it necessarily hard for the reader, but it's a well-expressed thing, and nobody really gives Tolkien a hard time for what he did. It's just maybe the names are more, I don't know, familiar to an English-speaking ear, so we don't give Tolkien the same kind of problem.
Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Byte Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, what's your secret? Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
If you like a good murder mystery story, you'll love June's Journey, a free hidden object mobile game where Detective June Parker unravels the mystery of her sister's death. Travel back to the beautifully illustrated 20s, find clues, discover hidden objects, and watch the story unfold with new chapters released weekly. Put your detective skills to the test. Download June's Journey on Android or iOS, or play online via Facebook games.
Let's talk about A Desolation Called Peace. This is the sequel, as we've said, to Memory Called Empire, one of my favorite books of a couple of years ago. In this book, the picks up kind of right where the first book left off, where we've got our... So in the first book, our main character, Mahit, is sent from her space station on the border of this empire to the capital of the empire. And because the ambassador there has died. And the idea is you're loaded with the mind or the memories of the previous ambassador. And so she is, but there's a malfunction and she goes there. And so she doesn't really know what that previous ambassador was doing because they hadn't come home in 10 years anyway. So the memories that she got were out of date, and then there was a malfunction, so she didn't have access to them. So she has to stumble along and try to make friends in the middle of conflicts involving this empire and the imperial palace and all sorts of political stuff going on. And she sort of fumbles and stumbles and bumbles around until she gets some friends and makes some pretty dramatic decisions about what to do, including some kind of, I don't know how to say, outlaw brain surgery that happens.
Yeah, that's basically it. Sure.
Little unregulated brain surgery in order to try to solve the issues that are going on with the fact that she doesn't have access to the memory of the guy that she's replacing. And so she makes some allies and all of that. In doing all of this, she's kind of blown up. Her relationship with her home is really in question, especially since she always kind of loved the empire and was a fan of their poetry and stuff like that. And in A Desolation Called Peace, what's interesting is it picks up with her being recalled home and discovering that everybody's got it in for her back on the station.
And it's not that she was recalled home. She chose to come home. So at the beginning of this book, she's been home for about 3 months and has spent the entire time basically just wandering around and trying to reinsert herself into this society, which she no longer really feels like she belongs in. And during that, the 3 months that sort of happened in between the two books, she doesn't go and like basically report in to anybody that she's supposed to, because she feels so like she doesn't know where she fits in, and she doesn't know which of those people is responsible for the malfunction that happened in the first book. So there's a lot of like stuff going on in her head before this even starts.
Yeah. So it's fascinating because she's an interesting character, right? Because she's sort of the outsider who's brought inside, but has been a fan of the inside all along. And so it's this weird, like you are, but you aren't to both sides, mm-hmm. right? She's never enough of the Teshkalani to be an official member of the empire. They always say you're an alien, essentially. You're an outlander. You're a hayseed. You're never, ever, ever, ever going to fit in.
Barbarian.
A barbarian, right, exactly. But then back on the station, she's like way too imperial and, you know, with airs and likes poetry and stuff. And plus the political of like that she was sabotaged on top of all of that. It's just, I really love, again, a little bit of an outsider character here. Kind of interesting. I guess I kind of enjoy that. Anyway, so that's going on. Meanwhile, aliens are attacking the empire.
Aliens.
Weird aliens are attacking the empire, which is causing all sorts of new political trouble. This is just like the other book. There's like a new emperor. It's actually kind of fun. They're both similar in that way. Even though this is like a space opera all the way. Aliens attack, and they got to figure out how to deal with it. And one thing leads to another, and Mahit's good friend / love close interest friend. Three yeah, Seagrass stopped on by the station and said, "Hey, I'm heading out to deal with these aliens. You want to come along? And at that point, my heat's essentially like, yes, they are trying to kill me. Why don't you bring me with you? And off they go to try and see if they can communicate with an alien hive mind that doesn't seem to want to communicate with anyone. Just kill them. And that is what Desolation Cult Peace is all about. How did I do?
Oh, that's pretty good. Great, Jason.
There's
so
also
good.
The whole subplot that I enjoyed with the replacement emperor who is trying to learn about.
Oh, yeah. Right,
there's a like young tactics. Clone.
Mm-hmm. Young clone. Shades of Foundation.
Yeah, and he's sort of also being, I don't want to say quite like groomed, but like there's a, you know, there's a conflict over like people who are trying to both teach him and influence him, uh-huh. kind of.
Right, because he's hanging out at like the Admiralty, basically, like
Ministry
right.
of War.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. And they're like, "Oh,
are
yeah.
you supposed to be here?"
And he's like, "Well, I'm gonna be the emperor, so I guess we gotta let him in." But they're like, "Do we disclose to him? Is he a spy or is he an opportunity?" And the answer is,
yes.
He's a spy, yes. really, actually. But yes, sure, it is an opportunity to be that, and that's also happening on. And they all have wacky names again, because remember, this mm-hmm. is the series that brought us 20 helicopters.
I do love it.
And you know what? Weirdly, I had no problem with the language in this book, even though I didn't go back and reread the first one in this series. It did take me a little while. Like I think I want to say it was like 2 or 3 chapters, and I was struggling a little bit. And then at some point, it just sort of clicked again, and my brain was just like rewired into the way mm-hmm. it needed to be for this. And I just zipped through the rest of it without a pause.
It's funny, in my head, I suddenly thought it reminds me of when I studied psychology back in high school, and it was like the two different types of aphasia, is like the aphasia where it's like you make garbage, like you make noises that are unintelligible, and the aphasia where you have all the right words, but you can't put them, like, you say things that are correct words, like 3 seagrass, that has no meaning when you put it together.
Yep. 20 helicopter. It's fine. 9 hibiscus. 8 antidote, by the way, is the name of the
8 antidote. Yep. Yeah. I like it's a good name.
19 ads, who becomes, that's how you pronounce it, right? Ads? I can't think of, it's like an axe,
ADC,
right? Yeah, like, she whose gracious presence illuminates the room like the edge sign of a knife. Did not have that memorized, had to look it up. She's a wonderful character because I think, like, I think there's a lack of viciousness at times in this novel about Empire, which is an interesting way, you know, the Emperor, or how much spoilers are we going to do in the previous book?
Yeah, sure.
Well, so the Emperor in the previous book commits kind of this ritual act and sacrifices himself in a really profound way to move the society forward after he's essentially denied this weird, not really form of immortality. It's not really immortality at all. It's like a weird echo. And that's a great little rumination running through the first book about the nature of sort of memory and self. And so that's kind of neat. But so it ends with that, and you have, you know, essentially a new emperor, 19 ads, and an 8 antidote as the
other plot, right? Meanwhile, back at the Empire capital, not out in the frontier.
19, yeah. But it's, you know, he's saying I've managed to oversee, you know, 80 years of peace, and I want to have, you know, 800 years or something. Mm-hmm. And their definition of peace is we've subjugated everybody we can. Yes. We keep suppressing rebellions and we're expanding. So for us, that's peace. And it's presented as kind of a matter of fact, it's as a tension in the book, like not absorbing that worldview. But 19 ads is, even though, you know, she was younger than the emperor just died by a substantial amount. And so she's now the, you know, the emperor, and she doesn't have, I mean, I guess this is the thing. There's like a certain kind of viciousness I expect from Empire, and the Foundation series, just sort of side reference, I think does a wonderful job in a way that I think I've rarely seen depicted on screen, of showing the kind of absolute ruthlessness you need to rule a, you know, galactic or a solar system spanning empire, these huge, sweeping, horrible gestures. And this book, I think, wrestles with that a bit. So in any other book, any other thing, 19 ads would have had 8 antidote killed at various points, clearly. And in this one, not. It's education.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I also got the impression that 19 ads was like, yep, she's the emperor, but that's not a thing that she was ever actually aiming for. She really, she genuinely loved the previous emperor and was very sad when he died. And I think will be happy to turn the empire over to 8 antidote
again,
when the time comes.
Totally. Yeah.
Yeah, I liked all the intrigue in the court politics. That was one of my favorite parts of the first book as well. I just enjoy sort of the you know, layers upon layers of plots and all that stuff. And I think it's well played out here as well. I thought that the Eight Antidote makes an interesting character through which to see all of this, you know, given his state as both someone who is a clone and is also kind of a kid.
Yeah.
And sort of dealing with that tension between those different parts of him as he tries to like understand both like what's going on and also try to figure out like, well, what do I take away from this that I need to do in the future? Mm-hmm. So all of that's really cool. And then we have the whole separate thing going on the ship where we have the, you know, the admiral or whatever, who's been kind of like basically sent out there. Like, isn't she essentially exiled or like sent to sort of be like, get out of the way?
It depends on who you ask.
A really good admiral. And so the hope is that maybe she'll win. If she gets killed, then she won't overthrow the empire. So
he'll be rid of her and it'll be okay.
Everybody wins.
Yeah. It's echoes. Isn't there a famous Roman thing where they send, you know, the Romans would send their most ambitious generals out to the, you know, farthest points of the empire. And then there was the whole crossing the Rubicon thing when one comes back and I forgot, that's not Caesar, Julius Caesar, is it? Anyway, but it's got real shades of that. Like, yes, you did very well. We shall be sending you to Londinium on far from here.
That complexity and ambivalence about a lot of this stuff, I think, is one of the reasons that I love these books, because these books are they're not like, I'm going to write a book that lays bare everything that's bad about kind of empires and how they smash everything down. And it's not that. It's more like, I'm going to interrogate the idea. And in fact, I'm going to use space opera, which is a genre about that has become in large part about empires, various kinds, as a way to interrogate the idea of empires and how they work and what their effects are. And it's not just about the people who are on the fringe, although it is about that, and Mahit's space station is a great example of that, but it's also about the people who have been like integrated into the empire, but they're integrated in brutal ways because that's how they work. Like, we flatten you and then you're in the empire. Great. But also, like, with the kid, with Eight Antidote, you know, even if you're at the core of it, you're literally the next emperor, the clone of the previous emperor, Eight Antidote has a lot to learn, and a lot of it is like, well, what have I internalized? And Eight Antidote goes, like, astray from what he's supposed to do and, like, goes off to where there's the, like, the hollow fighter jet and talks his way into, like, to the communication relay, and like, he's learning all the parts of the empire, which is, it's really interesting because it's not just like the lies the empire tells people, but it's also the truth of what it is. And like, I love the richness and complexity of that, the idea that it is not it's not going to simplify it down. It has a very clear point of view about and is very critical about empires. It really is quite a bit critical about it, but it's doing it in a kind of, it's complicated way and showing it from all sorts of these perspectives. And it's something I loved about A Memory Called Empire, and it's something I love about this book too, is that it's showing you all of the different ways that this complicated monstrous machine can touch people.
Yeah, it's interesting that you mentioned him, Eight Antidote, and how he sort of is learning and kind of goes his own way, because that ties into what we were just talking about before in terms of Admiral Nine Hibiscus, who, when Eight Antidote asks the Emperor why Nine Hibiscus is out there, the Emperor is the one that said, you know, maybe Nine Hibiscus is good enough to live through this, whereas it's the people at the Ministry of War who are saying, oh, no, this is a political move. Nine Hibiscus was sent out there to die because she's just too powerful. So you're getting both sides, and, you know, there's, everybody has their own thoughts about why she is where she is, and you get to see little Eight Antidote try to internalize all of that and make his own decisions about these things. And then on the other hand, you have Mahit, who her people were, they have not yet quite been colonized by the Empire because they still have their own, you know, supposedly separate space station, but their culture has been very heavily colonized because she spent her entire, you know, young adult life growing up and, you know, basically posters of poets on the walls, I assume.
Yeah.
She's just really in love with the whole Taixkalan Empire. And she both does and does not want to be a part of it. And one of the big issues between her and Three Seagrass is that Three Seagrass sees her as a barbarian, and she just feels, you know, brokenhearted every time this person that she cares about mentions her as a barbarian over and over and over again. And it's just, oh, it gets my heart.
Yeah.
I was going to bring up the character 20 Cicada,
yeah,
who is kind of like, I guess, the I don't know, adjunct or something for the admiral, and how that is a great character in this book. And kind of, you know, this book obviously is influenced by the Roman Empire, right? And what the Romans did was they constantly expanded, and once they stopped, their empire collapsed. But part of their expansion was that they would, you know, destroy your civilization. But then they would adopt the pieces that they liked and let the local people kind of run the things and just send the taxes. We'll take your gods. Now you worship our gods. They're the same gods. It's fine. And so you kind of, you assimilate into the empire. And 20 Cicada has assimilated to a certain point, but he is also a proponent, or he has some kind of strange to the rest of the empire religion, and he has these tattoos that mark him as kind of an other, but he's not a barbarian, but he's not fully a member of, you know, he's not a fully
assimilated.
He is to put too fine a point on it, he is the immigrant to America who hasn't completely melted into the melting pot because he keeps parts of his existing culture. And so how are you of a place and yet not quite of a place? That is where 20 Cicada lives. Until he offers himself up to be joined to the alien hive mind, which happens.
It does. And that gave me a big Star Trek II feels when Spock sacrifices. Oh, spoilers for Star Trek II. Spock dies at the end.
What?
And the sacrifice.
And he never comes back. He just dies and is dead forever.
After that.
There's this interesting exploration too. Boy, this book has a lot in it, doesn't it? This is packed tight for being a pretty quick read as well. Although I think I would argue, as with the other book, it's kind of a little half of a book. I think this is a little more noticeably ends at a middle point. But
it is book two in a trilogy, and what's going to happen? I mean, I feel it's self-contained in the sense that the adventure the aliens is kind of addressed, but our main character at the end is sort of like, well, now what, right?
Comes next? But so there's a meditation in there, or maybe not a meditation, but it's the notion of group consciousness, right? And I don't think this is spoilery to say there's three different kinds that get explored, and the alien one is the one that comes out more early, but it's a notion of like, how does self get lost in some kind of groupthink, the society? Well, actually, I mean, four, if you say the empire is a kind of groupthink.
Oh, yeah.
Five, the station is a kind of groupthink.
Oh, yeah.
And then you have actual literal science fiction, or almost like telepathic-ish groupthink that occurs too. So you have every kind of different way of having people aligned. I mean, actually, there's another one too, right? We know this from the first book. You've read that the sunlight, the armed forces clearly have some kind of group mind. So like everywhere you look, there's a sort of group mind thing happening, but it's somewhat different kind of one.
Yeah, I think that's a great point that the one of the themes here is definitely something that is larger than the sum of its individual elements. And do you lose the individual elements when that happens? And so being prompted by an alien hive mind, there is the parallelism is very strong there, which is like, this is kind of like being absorbed in the empire, right? Like it is kind of,
Empire's kind of got some, it is one of the, you know, the biggest sci-fi tropes is that there's some kind of hive mind and it sucks you in and you lose your individuality. And then you're like, oh, the hive mind is wonderful. And this ends without that sense of it.
Yeah. I was really happy that it went a more Star Trek-y kind of way, almost, where it's like it's a problem to solve, which is like, we can figure this out. The aliens, like, they're out on that hot, awful planet, and they're like, oh, the aliens are back. All right, maybe we'll maybe it'll work this time. And it works. Like, they figure it out how to communicate. And the aliens are like, oh, we didn't understand that you are individuals. We didn't get that. And I enjoyed that because I was...
Like, how does that work?
Yeah.
We don't understand.
It was kind of fun. And in the tone of both of these books, I expected it would be more nihilistic and terrible. These books are not nihilistic, but these books are dark and bad things happen at points. And at that point, I thought, like, oh, it's going to be awful, isn't it? Something terrible is going to happen. It's like, not really.
No. In the middle of this book, I got to say, I was totally loving the whole relationship between our, you know, our friends, between 3 Seagrass and Mahit. And it was great. And you see it developing, and there's a little of this, you know, will they, won't they, and what's going to happen? And I'm like, you know, and honestly, I don't usually think this. I hope this won't make me seem prurient. I'm like, there should be a sex scene in this book because, come on, like, this is a book for adults. It's very complicated. The two of them, like, I wonder if it's going to happen. And then you're like, oh my gosh, okay, well, that was a little.
They want it so much, okay. and then they get it. So
and it was good. I did not feel it was not an embarrassment. Interesting sex scene. It was actually very romantic and
earned. It was really earned too.
Yeah, it was great. It's great. Then they're embarrassed later, and I'm like, that's so much more realistic that they're like embarrassed about each other. And it's good.
Yeah, I love this. I love this series. I love how it is talking about lots of sort of big ideas and using the giant canvas of space opera to do it. And you know, it's not reinventing the wheel here. In fact, I see a lot of echoes of the Ancillary series.
I was thinking the same thing. Yep.
Right? Mm. Like the Ancillary series, episode one, Ancillary Justice, episode one with the Roman numeral one. Ancillary Justice is your introduction to this big empire. And then episode two, Ancillary Mercy? Is the one where they're on like Deep Space Nine basically for the whole episode. Mm-hmm. And this is a little like that, except they're on the Enterprise in part two, where it's like, now we're going to have an alien encounter on a spaceship, and like, okay. And yet, it is also its own thing with its own little quirks and its own things that it's trying to interrogate about our society through the lens of the space opera, which I love. But like,
it's fun too.
I couldn't
get enough
of this stuff. Yeah,
it's a great read. And I found the name that I couldn't find. I found this in the index when we were talking about this before. It's the greatest name ever created in the books. It's 36 All-Terrain Tundra Vehicle, who's a convert to the Empire, and this is the name he takes. And they're like, "How gauche."
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, it is. I think that, I mean, I very much love the Ancillary series, but I didn't find it as funny as I find these books.
I agree.
Fun. Like, there are points where I laughed out loud at the thing that I was reading. And that doesn't happen super often. And it just has a bit of a wry humor to it threaded throughout. And there are, like you said, there are definitely dark things happening. And it is, you know, it's full of big ideas, but it's told, you know, through the points of view of different enough characters that I feel like it's grounded in a way, which is a weird thing to say about space opera, but it's grounded, and I feel like I am understanding it from the point of view of people with whom I can relate very, very clearly and very closely. And that made it a really fun experience for me to read through.
Look, Erica, we already established that planets are in space, so... Being grounded is a thing that space opera can do. It's fine.
Fair, I guess. Yep.
I like that at one point late in the book, after lots of effort, the jerk who is basically her enemy from her home space station shows up. And it's like, oh God, now why are you
this
here
guy.
Now? And that's why where we leave her at the end is at the end of the book. It's sort of like, maybe you should just be in the Empire now. And she's like,
that doesn't sound right either.
They're going to kill me back home probably. So maybe, but that doesn't seem right. Right. But I'm not. Do I really want to be? Because I'm a barbarian. And she's left in the place for the third book, presumably, to deal with all of that. But like that is good stuff, because that's Mahit's whole story, right?
Yeah.
Is that she's neither fish nor fowl. She is an outsider dreaming of being on the inside, but can't ever really be on the inside. But by dreaming about it, she's on the outside from her own people. And then where is she? And the answer is in space. That's where she is, just floating in space.
Yeah. I appreciated in the first book that there were all these hints about the hive mind. Like, it was great how they were woven throughout. It's kind of like, oh, there's a lurking terror, and eventually you're gonna have to deal with that. Yeah. And then also in the first book, though, it ends without a resolution. It's kind of hinted at, mentioned a couple times in the second book. The meatball surgery she has done in her head is like, somebody on the home world has one of these, you know, memory cube or memory balls, and like, we know it's gonna come back. So it's the, you know, we've got the Chekhov's memory cube or whatever is going to return.
And that's actually another really interesting bit of this book that I like so much, more even than in the first book. Like, in the first book, she has, you know, kind of a broken version through most of it of this previous ambassador talking to her in her head. And now in this book, she has still that broken version, but also the more recent version. So she's got like two different versions of this other character talking to her, and then her own thoughts, and trying to sort of integrate all of those things in a way that is supposed to work very smoothly, but because she was sabotaged, it's not working very smoothly. So the idea of having other people in your head, which, you know, we kind of talked about a little bit when talking about, like, you know, group think and that sort of thing with the aliens, this is like a subtly different version of that. And just like, there are shades and layers, and it just, I just love this book, and I want there to be another one right now.
Yeah. Any other thoughts about Desolation Called Peace?
It's good.
Good book.
Bold choice. Bold opinion.
Good book. Probably going to get nominated for an award. Guess what? We already read it. Ha.
Oh, yeah, I'll take that.
Head of that game.
Locust.
Bzzz. The locusts.
I would just point out there's one other little fun thing that I liked in both books, which is, you know, I absolutely love this naming convention, which I've never seen in any other book, and it's done very consistently, amusingly, and it's great, and it's meaningful, right? It's not just kind of thrown at people. There's a whole sort of iconography and so forth, and but it's the fact that everyone's nicknames are like kind of variations, like you know, Map is was it Nine Cartography or something? Not Nine Cartography. I forgot, one of the kids, Five Cartography. And three sea grass is called Reed by her close friend, and then Mohit adopts that, and Swarm for it's a 20 locust, cicada. Yeah. So anyway, it's just, I just like that little, like, the pet nickname thing being derived, and it, like, it felt very natural the first time it showed up in the first book. I was like, oh, that totally makes sense. That's exactly how friends would talk to each other.
All right, let's move on to a little final segment, which is books that we've been reading that we liked lately. But I call it What Are We Reading, because books that we are reading that we liked lately is a dumb name. So what are we reading? Scott McNulty, what are you reading? What books have you liked lately that you're reading or that you read that you're... What are you reading? That's
books that
saying.
I have recently perhaps read and kind of vaguely remember.
Recommendations for books for people to read that are not the books that we already read. That
This title just gets clunkier and clunkier.
Again, I'm just proving my point. What are we reading, Scott?
I don't know. What are we reading? People by this point are probably sick and tired of me suggesting that they read K.J. Parker. But
again,
I will say that the final book in his trilogy, the Siege trilogy, which started with 16 Ways to Defend a Walled City, is something that I read recently. It's called A Practical Guide to Conquering the World, and it features a character who lived in or who's from the city from the first book that I don't want to ruin what happens in the first book, but things happen. This character is impacted and then uses much chicanery and knowledge to, in a very unlikely series of events, to kind of change the entire world. So it's good, and it's very of K.J. Parker. And if you read K.J. Parker, you know what that means. Speaking of another trilogy, the Greenbone Saga is Fonda Lee's trilogy. Jade Legacy was the final book in that series. I read it. It is a very long book that feels like four books put together. As I was reading it, I was enjoying it, but I kept thinking, is this the end of the, because this is, oh no, this is not. So it covers like the first two books in this series, I felt like did not cover the same time span that this last book does. But it's a really good ending to the trilogy. So if you like that book, that trilogy, you should read the third one.
Keep,
I don't know.
Keep reading it. Yeah, I read the first one of those and I liked it. So yeah.
I will round out my trilogy session with a third book that is not in a trilogy, but it is the third of my trilogy of recently read books. See what I did there. Light from Uncommon Stars, which is by a person whose name I will probably butcher, Rika Aoki, maybe? I apologize to everyone, but that yes, perhaps is their name. It features a demonic violin teacher who needs...
Let you repeat yourself. Yeah.
...needs to get her final soul to hell so that she can fulfill her contract. And there's also some refugee aliens that are running a donut shop. And these two things, and it's set in, you know, our current time period. And so these two storylines merge and hijinks ensue.
Nice. Wow. Erica, what are you reading?
I am reading, I recently discovered that Shauna Maguire has actually another two novellas in the Wayward Children series.
I heard that she had a new one and I looked and it turns out she had two new ones.
Yep. So I have started reading Wayward Children number 6. I will move on to number 7 once I finished it. So I'm like about halfway through. It's called Across the Green Grass Fields, mm-hmm. and I am loving it. I've liked all of them. Some of them I have connected with more than others. This is one that I am definitely hardcore connecting with. It's the Wayward Children series is such a good series. Yeah, it's where, like, the idea is there are magical doors, and sometimes children go through these doors, you know, think about the Wizard of Oz, that sort of thing. But then they come back, and life ain't so easy once you come back. So the very first novella, Every Heart a Doorway, is about a school for these kinds of children to sort of go and learn how to be in the world again and maybe hopefully find their door. This book is actually kind of coming at it from the angle that your stereotypical books come at it. You're actually meeting a child when they are still on Earth with their family and the experience of them finding a door. And I think that it's kind of neat that it took until book 6 to actually get the sort of stereotypical version of this. And it's a young girl who, she's like 10 years old, I think, and she really, really loves horses. And she ends up in a world where there are centaurs and unicorns. And I haven't finished it, so I don't know for sure if I will end up loving it, but I'm in love with it so far. And it's just really delightful. So I'm going to read that. And then the next one I read will probably be Wayward Children number 7, which I don't remember the name of off the top of my head. But I also then will very briefly mention that I recently finished City of Stairs by Robert Jackson Bennett, because you guys recommended it to me and I enjoyed it. And I have actually, I hadn't gone on to the next book yet because I enjoyed it, but I didn't like super, super enjoy it. But I just listened to episode 600 of The Incomparable.
Oh, yes.
And, yeah. And heard you guys talking about how great the other books in the series were. And I was like, you know what? I should probably then, I should continue. Yeah. So
I love that book, but it does, like Dan was saying, it keeps
getting
better.
It's the least good of the three.
And I love it.
Which is weird. It's like, I liked that book a lot, but then I kept reading. I was like, wow, these other books are way better.
Yeah. Funny. And I, honestly, if I hadn't listened to you say those words, Dan, I'm not sure that I would have actually gone on and read any farther. But as it stands now, I have already placed a hold on City of Blades.
Excellent.
So
great.
As soon as that comes through on my Kobo, I'm jumping to that next.
More people need to read those books. I guess we're doing our part by telling people they need to read those books.
Thank you. I salute you.
You know, Dan and Scott told me, and then we all told Erica, and now Erica's telling everybody out there. And you just when are you going to believe us? When?
Get with the program, folks. Yep. But that's it for me.
Okay. Glenn, anything to recommend?
Yeah, you know, I'm kind of a weirdo, so I've been reading type-related books. So I recently read Palatino, A History of the Typeface Palatino, surprisingly in-depth, and also Index, A History of the, which is a pretty cute book by a guy I know about, the history of the Index. Very, very entertaining stories. I was thinking about detective novels, because I noticed Michael Chabon mentioned on Twitter, he said something about The Glass Key, a Dashiell Hammett novel. I seem to be totally unaware of it. I'm like, what is this?
Yeah, I read that one.
Yeah, so I got the complete novels, remembering that he only wrote four complete novels, yeah. impossibly, and read the four is Red Harvest, The Dane Curse, five, The Maltese Falcon, The Glass Key, and The Thin Man, and was like, man, this Dashiell Hammett, pretty good writer. But The Glass Key is one of the strangest, mm-hmm. I would say, if I hadn't read that, I think The Witness for the Dead and The Glass Key actually have a lot in common. You have this sort of troubled person wandering around. It's very a meditative thing. People are dying left and right. Things sort of happen, but it's almost dreamlike. And anyway, if you haven't read all of Dashiell Hammett's works, like apparently I hadn't, that's what I read, and I enjoyed going through his oeuvre.
Nice. Dan?
I got a few. I'll start off with, I think I've mentioned this before, but I read the second book in a trilogy. Ah, it's the thing we're doing.
But you're listing it first.
I read it most recently.
Okay.
The Liar's Knot, which is the second book in the Rook and Rose series, which I think I've recommended elsewhere, which is by M.A. Carrick, who is two people jointly writing. It's really good fantasy. It kind of reminds me a little bit, I think I've said this, of Scott Lynch. It's set in kind of a Renaissance-ish style world. There's magic. There are a sort of variety of political intrigues going on within this city. The main character is a con woman who is basically trying to trick her way into the nobility and ends up getting more than she bargains for in sort of the first book by basically realizing that tricking her way into a family, she has somehow become subject to this curse that's on this family. Not great. So there's a lot of sort of fun stuff, swashbuckling adventure, a lot of romance, some sort of mystical and magical elements that happen as well. They are long books, but they're good. Like if you like a big hefty fantasy tome, and they're fun. Like that's the thing I would say is most of all is like they are really entertaining ripping reads, and you will, even though they are many hundred pages, you will just be flipping them as you go because they are incredibly engrossing. So highly recommend both of those. And I believe the third one has already been at least delivered and should be out sometime this year, maybe late this year. I will say those get a wholehearted recommendation from me. They're really great. I'll also add a book that is coming out, which I got to read early, called Breaking Day, by an author named Adam Oyebanji. It's set on a generation ship, one of three that's escaped Earth, which has been basically now ruled by AI. And they're heading off to start a new planet. And it's almost time for them to hit the point where the ships have to start breaking and slowing down to make their approach. And we have our main character who is an engineer in training named Ravi. And as he's on inspection one day, he sees a woman floating outside in space with no helmet on and nobody else can see her. So it starts off with sort of a pretty big sort of intriguing moment, like what the heck is going on? And there's a mystery that unfolds as he sort of starts investigating these visions he seems to be having, along with sort of politics and factions on the ship. Some people aren't as thrilled about this idea of going to a new planet. And he's got it delves into sort of the social strata within the ship and all the different class struggles of the families. And it's fun. It's a good read. It's got a great mystery to it. It really kept me guessing. The world of these generation ships is really well sort of fleshed out. There's a lot of culture that's happening, that's come up, all these people are people who have been on the ship the entire life, right? So they don't have any context for anything else. And so he does a nice job of explaining sort of what is it like living on these things? So that was a pretty good read. I really enjoyed that. And then last of all, a book that I believe Jason read, and that's why I started reading it. And I'm on the second one in the series, The Steerswoman.
Oh, yeah.
What a weird, interesting book. I went into it having heard you talk about it, I think, Jason, and been this sounds intriguing. I'll read this. And I read it. It was not what I expected, and yet I still enjoyed it. And enough so that I picked up the second one, which I'm almost done with at this point. But these books are from like late 80s, early 90s. Yeah, they're kind of a weird fantasy sci-fi mashup.
They're fantasy novels that are kind of secretly sci-fi novels, but you have to kind of watch for the clues.
Yes. Yes. That's the fun part, is trying to figure out sometimes when things happen. You're like, wait a second.
Because what it doesn't do is say, and then there was a robot. Instead, it will be like a strange, I mean, I'm making this up, but there's maybe not robots in it. It's unclear. But it's like a strange man, but his face was reflective as if made from a metal. And you're like, is that a robot that she's describing there?
And there's a lot of stuff where you can't figure out, like, is this a real thing? Or is this sort of weird sci-fi thing
that is magic?
Being interpreted through the lens of somebody who doesn't understand technology?
Yeah.
It's very clever.
There are four of those books. She's continuing to write them, but what happened, basically, she got dropped by her publisher. She got the rights back. She republished them all herself, so you can get them all as ebooks. And she's continuing to write the series. And I've read all four now, and they're great.
Interesting. Yeah, I've heard you talk about them. Now I've heard Dan talk about them. I've also seen many people tweet about them, so I feel like I will be following suit one of these days.
Yeah, it's just... I really did not know what to expect, but they are fun. They are fun. I enjoy the whole conceit of the main character, who is essentially a part of an order where they ask people questions.
A little bit like a witness for the dead. This is not quite the same, but it's similar, and they're compelled. They're compelled to ask people questions and answer questions.
And if you don't answer their questions,
you're banned.
It's not good for you.
No soup for you.
So, yeah, I'm enjoying it. I will probably keep reading those because I don't have anything else sort of like perking up my to read list right now.
They're fun. They're fun. And I think they get increasingly, like as so often happens, I think as a writer writes their third novel and their fourth novel and she's living in this series, like, they get increasingly complex in a good way. I think they get better as they go, but also they're very different. Like there's the one that's
second book is all like set amongst the tribes, the outskirter tribes. And you're like, this is like 180 degrees from where I was in the first book.
Yeah. Well, Dan, they go to a place in the fourth book that you're like, I cannot believe what is happening now because it's not like nothing before. Like, there's a lot of good stuff in those books. Rosemary Kirstein.
I just bought it. $3.39 Canadian on Kobo. So what a bargain.
Yeah, she's selling them herself. So there's no middleman. So cheap. Mm-hmm. And they're totally worth it. Thank you, Dan.
No problem.
I have four that I'm going to mention. A Master of Gin by P.J. Lee Clark.
Ah, I like that one.
Good.
That was good.
Book set in the Haunting of Tram Car number whatever universe where there's magic in Egypt, and Egypt has become a power in the early 20th century because of some spells that freed magic up, and the jinn are building buildings in Cairo. And this book is basically the guy who started it all comes back from the dead and kills a bunch of people, and people are like, whoa, what's going on? And a detective who is the first full-fledged woman detective in the magic office, and she wears Western suits and she's pretty cool, and she's like, I don't believe it. I think this is all a scam by somebody who's committed murder, and I'm gonna figure it out. And friend, that's what the book's about. It's great. solving a magical mystery, and there's lots of nonsense that goes along the way, and it's good. Naomi Novik's The Last Graduate, the second book in the Scholomance series. I loved it. I loved it as much as the first one. I can't wait for the third one. The Scholomance series is essentially, imagine if they built Hogwarts, but what happens is every year they just shovel a bunch of kids in and lock the doors. And they stay in there until they graduate.
But Hogwarts on a hellmouth.
But by the time they graduate, most of them are dead. Because inside the school is trying to kill them all. That's the Scholomance. And I love it. And in this book, they try to finally outwit the Scholomance and escape. And it turns out it doesn't go the way that you think. Because like Harry Potter, it's sort of like, we're going to tell you the story of this year. And you're like, okay, I read the first book. I know what's going to happen in year two. And that doesn't happen in year two. It's quite shocking that it doesn't happen. Instead, different things happen. Such a good series. Naomi Novik, good job. Love it. The Shattered Skies is the sequel to John Birmingham's Cruel Stars.
Cruel Stars, yeah.
Cruel Stars. Wide screen space opera, lots of explosions, lots of kind of fun characters. This book is, I didn't like it as much as the Cruel Stars, but I appreciated some of the things that he tries with it, including in the first book, basically, there's the old crusty old man on the sand planet who's investigating the last relic of the Great War against the space Nazis that were won by the anti-fascist type people, so to speak. And everybody else thinks he's like a lunatic because we beat the space Nazis and they're never coming back. And he's like, oh, they're going to come back. And when they do, I'm going to be the guy who knows all about them. And guess what happens in that book? They come back and he's the guy who knows all about them. So in The Shattered Skies, we get to spend some time with the space Nazis. And
oh, great.
And it's actually really interesting because they're terrible, and yet it also sort of in the spirit of the Texcalon books, the non-space Nazi star empires, they're not so great either. And like he's also poking and prodding while things are exploding. He's also poking and prodding a little bit at some of the preconceptions of it. I don't think the space Nazis are as interesting, and I think it slows the book down, but I actually, it's more of the same of the first book, and they're fun. They're not, I would say, I think John Birmingham himself would say they're not necessarily the kind of book that you ponder deeply and write a thesis about. They're more the kind of book that you open a bottle of wine while you're on a plane and you read them and things explode and it's fun. That's about right. That's nothing wrong with that. It's good stuff.
You take some fancy plane rides.
Open a bottle. Well, John does, but he's in Australia. I think they have wine on planes in Australia. Well, they have to fly like 10, 15 hours just to get anywhere. So they serve them wine to knock them out.
Just
that's
bring
what they
your
do.
Own bottle of wine, I was imagining. That's,
yeah, though, no, the corkage fees for bringing your own bottle of wine on a plane, man. Woo! And finally, I started reading the Merchant Princess series by Charles Stross.
Oh, boy.
I've read like six of them.
I think I gave up around four.
I can't stop. Well, maybe, I don't know. I can't stop.
I gave up, Jason, for reasons.
I can't stop. They're, well, okay, maybe I've only read five of them.
Oh, that's all. Okay. Oh,
I don't know.
Who among us has not read five of them?
I think that they're fun and they're fast reads and they are wild because it's people jumping from parallel universe to parallel universe. And the story is that there's like our universe and then there's one that's parallel to it that's like a medieval society, but and they've been secretly like making money smuggling drugs in there.
It's incredibly clever conceit. Like I loved the premise of this book.
And then it turns out there's another parallel and it turns out there's another parallel.
Yeah. That I think I just got a little worn out after a while.
But there's an alt Boston in the third parallel, Dan, and it's actually ruled by a cruel king of America. They're fun. And the idea there is that there's a woman who's a tech journalist and she discovers she's actually secretly the heir to a throne of a medieval country and can jump from parallels to parallels. And believe me, you don't want to be an heir to the throne of that country because it's awful and they're awful people. I love it. So I'm just going to keep reading them until I guess I grow tired of them, but there are apparently a zillion of them. So Merchant Princess, start with the family trade. I think you can get that as an inexpensive omnibus edition. You can buy two at once for cheap. So check it out. And that's it. That's it. We did it, everybody. Let us forget everything that we've said about these books we've forgotten. Until the next time.
We will never speak of this again.
Until they're nominated for awards and we have to recap what we did in this episode.
Speak of this again. At least.
Let us speak of this.
That's the downside. All right. Let me thank my panel for being here. Glenn Fleischman, thank you for being here. Nice visitor to the book club. It's good to hear from you.
Thanks. Thank you. And look, I didn't ruin it somehow.
No, we'll let the listeners judge. Dan Morin, thank you for being here.
It was a pleasure to remember books that I'd forgotten.
Yeah, isn't it always? Erica Ensign, thank you.
It was nice to be here. I suggested this episode halfway through reading one of the books and then determined I didn't love it, but I'm still glad I was here.
Well, I forgot that you suggested it, so you could have gotten away with it.
Oh!
It's a theme. And Scott McNulty, thank you.
Thank you for having me, Jason.
And thanks to everybody out there for listening. We hope we have, again, prompted you to know that you are going to read that book, or maybe think, maybe I won't read that book. Either way, it's fine. And we will see you next week. Goodbye.